So, are you in debt? If so, you're not alone. We will put debt into perspective during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, financial planner Kevin McKinley will also weigh in on whether you should use a 529 plan or a regular savings account to save for college. He'll have some advice on the best way to use a home equity line of credit. And we'll talk about whether it's the end of the road for Windows XP. Plus, as always, answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Well, let's talk about debt. The latest figures on different kinds of debt can provide some insight into the economic past, present, and future. And Kevin, I hope you can put this into perspective on what it means for our own personal situations.
You bet. We'll be talking about mortgages and student loans, but today we're going to address credit card debt. According to figures provided by the Federal Reserve and assembled by the website nerdwallet.com, there is about $854 billion of credit card debt out there right now. And that's actually down from recent years when it was approaching $1 trillion. And less than 50% of households actually carry credit card debt in America right now.
So how does this work out? What's the average credit card debt balance per household?
Well, the average balance is about $15,000. According to the figures from the Federal Reserve, but the median is a different story. It's about $3,000 to $4,000, meaning half the people have a balance higher than that and half that don't. So based on those recent numbers, it shows that there are a lot of people who carry a small balance of a few thousand dollars a month. And usually I think those people probably have a low interest rate special where they are just rolling it over. They feel no urgent need to pay it off. But there are some other people out there who are raising the average up, curve raisers, if you will, have a much higher balance than even that average amount.
Yeah. So what kind of interest rate are credit card owners generally paying?
It's still pretty steep. We're looking at about 13% on average for fixed rate and 15% on variable rate credit card accounts. And the variable one is scary because, of course, variable means that it can go up and it's unlikely to go much lower unless the credit card owner gets their situation in better shape than it currently is. One thing that is nicer to see is that some banks are warming up a little bit and sending more offers out to people with good credit, you know, 0% balance transfers or a low fixed interest rate for a certain period of time. That's fantastic. As long as if you're looking to pursue that and your credit is in very good shape. But you have to watch out because this can become a game of musical chairs. If you're one of those people who is kind of a serial credit card mover, meaning you move your balances from one place to the other, always looking for the lowest premium rate, sometimes that can not only damage your credit rating, but it can also, you can get stuck because either due to your situation or the current environment, you could get stuck at a place that has a very high interest rate and there are no other better offers out there for you.
So, generally, how are credit card owners doing in terms of making their payments?
Actually doing pretty well. In terms of the people who are behind more than 90 days, it's about 1.5% of credit card owners, and that's near a record low. Wisconsin just had one of the biggest declines in the nation in terms of state residents getting reducing the amount of people who are behind that far on their credit card payments. We're about half the national average, closer to about 0.8% of Wisconsin residents are more than 90 days behind on their credit card debt. And in terms of default, about 3% or so of credit card owners are in default. That, again, is a very low number and looks to be getting better soon just because it's really a case of people getting a little better at paying off their cards and paying them off in time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems positive. What kind of economic indicators does all of this information provide?
Credit card debt figures, they can be both a good and a bad sign for the economy. If there's more credit out there, it might be good because, like we mentioned, the lenders are willing to lend more, willing to give credit card options out to people who maybe couldn't have received the card under the similar terms 2 or 3 years ago. And it also means consumers are more willing to borrow because they're more confident that they're going to have the future income, that they're going to be able to pay it off down the road. And, of course, if they're spending money and putting it on a credit card, that debt spending is generally good for the economy as long as it's something that leads to more jobs, more spending, and more confidence. But the bad side of it is when consumers are spent using credit cards because they don't have the cash to pay for basic needs, such as gas or groceries or what have you. If they're looking at higher food and gas prices down the road, especially, and they're using credit cards to pay for it because they don't have the cash, that can create big problems. And then when those people default, some people would say, well, this doesn't, you know, I'm sorry for those people and I'm sorry for the banks that gave them the card, but if I don't default on my card, that doesn't really hurt me. Yes, it does, because generally the banks need to charge people more to pay for the people who do default, and they need to tighten their lending standards up to cover for people who may not be able to pay the bills. And finally, they may be put right back in the same situation that they were in 2008, where a lot of banks had some people who couldn't pay their mortgages or other loans, and created the banking crisis. And if that happens again, it's going to be difficult to dig us back out of that once more.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investors. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it's time now for the On Your Money email bag. And a listener named Ron says, good morning, Kevin and Joy. First, I must say, what an inspiring, entertaining, and insightful show you air. No, really, I must say that or you will not answer my question. We have them trained quite well,
Ron. Yeah, you're correct, Ron. Good for you.
My wife and I, he writes, have been putting money for our three children into a 529 plan since each of them has been just a few months old. I am concerned that if I continue to invest in the 529 plan that they may not use or need all of that money. Would we be better to stop the contributions and start diversifying the money in some type of an account that's more flexible and penalty-free?
That's a good question. Let's cover the 529 penalties first. 529s are tax-favored college savings account where just about anybody can put money aside for just about anybody else or themselves for future college expenses. Generally, don't get much of a tax break on the deposit. However, any earnings on the money invested in the account are sheltered from taxes. And then when you pull the money out and are using it for qualified higher education expenses, the withdrawals are tax-free. And that can include scholarships. Many times people are afraid, and if the kids get scholarships for school, which is less likely to happen than most people would believe, but if it does happen, you can generally pull out a commensurate amount from the 529, and that withdrawal would be tax-free.
So what if the 529 funds aren't used for qualified expenses or offset by a scholarship?
Well, the funds can be transferred to other family members, and if they need to pull it out for whatever reason, the penalties aren't as bad as people might assume. You only pay taxes on the earnings and plus a 10% penalty. So let's say they put $10,000 in for a kid and it grew to $11,000 over a few years. Then they pulled it out and they spent it on, you know, a car or some emergency expenses or whatever. They would only pay taxes and penalties on the $1,000 difference between what they put in versus what they put out. And they might pay, you know, say a third of that or so in taxes and penalties of the $1,000 of profit. So on an $11,000 withdrawal from a 529, they might end up spending about, oh, maybe $300 to $400 on taxes and penalties. So it's relatively small. And plus, there are usually no sunset provisions with these 529 accounts. So they can not only transfer it from one child to the other, but in many cases, you can transfer a 529 account down to a grandchild or a nephew, cousin, or some other close family member.
So do you think it's worth it to establish a second non-529 account?
Yeah, I think it can be, especially if people like to practice earmarking or compartmentalizing their savings. The separate account can serve as, you know, some other emergency account that people might need to spend on the kid for larger expenses such as, you know, braces or money for a band trip or something, or a foreign exchange trip. Or they might choose to use that money to contribute to a Roth IRA for the kid if they're fortunate enough to have kids who get jobs when they're in their teen years.
Okay. So, just because I'm dense here, so Ron would be better off stopping the contributions for the 529 and opening up a non-529 account?
I guess I'd like to see it split 50-50 in most cases between the two, just because I think the 529s definitely have value. But for children who are young, you never know if they're going to go to school, when they're going to go to school, what kind of expenses they're going to incur. So it's a great idea to save for it. I just don't want people to get too caught up into it, and especially not to forego other more important needs like paying off credit card debt that's at a high interest rate, or more importantly, saving for their own retirement, because you can borrow money to go to college, but you cannot borrow money to retire.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. 1-800-642-1234 is the number if you have a question about a money matter for Kevin, or you can email it onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our first caller is Philip in Madison. Hello, Philip. You're on the air.
Good morning, Joy and Kevin, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding 401k. Federal government requires that you take required minimum distribution at the age of 70 and a half. And my question is that if you are making quarterly payments on your taxes, and if you have your 401k invested 100% in stocks and bonds, do you have to liquidate those stocks and bonds to take the minimum distribution, or can you take a portion of the stocks and bonds and roll it over to a non-retirement account?
It depends in some cases on the plan itself and the language. Is there a reason, Philip, that you don't want to liquidate the account? What are you concerned about if you had to take it out in cash?
The idea is that if you are invested in stocks which you would like, or in bonds which you would like. So if your minimum distribution, let's say, is $40,000 a year, then I would rather take, let's say, 300 shares of company XYZ and roll it over to my non-retirement account as opposed to sell it and go and turn around and have to buy it all over again.
Yeah, that's an issue, but in most cases, especially if you use something, are you transferring the money into like a traditional brokerage account, or are you using something like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity?
Well, my 401k is at Vanguard in a trustee 401k trustee account, and then I would roll it over to my joint account.
Okay. Yeah, if that is the case, yes, you can pick and choose and take what they call an in-kind distribution from that. And you can designate the shares to be moved over for that other account. One thing I would watch out for, though, is that you might create an issue with the cost basis of those shares. If it were up to me, what I would have you do is just take the cash, move that over to another account, and then rebuy it. Because the good news about that is you get the purchase at a higher purchase price for it. You don't have to deal as much with the cost basis and eventually selling it, and try to account for that and then pay taxes on it as well. So my preference is just take the cash out of the account and then buy it. You can buy it almost immediately in the new account. And if you're using a low-cost financial custodian, it shouldn't cost you very much in commission.
Good luck to you, Philip. Thank you for the call. We'll get to more of your calls in just a moment. Plus, we will have some information and advice on HELOCs. And we will we'll talk about the Windows XP system a little bit later on. Is it the end of the road for Windows XP? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're in the money. We're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234 if you have a money question for him, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Beatrice in Port Washington is with us now. Hi, Beatrice, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning. I have two questions. The first one is regarding a 529. I have an account for my kids, and they are getting right now a subsidized loan, and that is not payable until 6 months after they finish college. So I was waiting. I was thinking to save the 529 and wait until I accrue more interest and then pay it at the end. But I do not know if that would be allowed to use that money to pay a loan, which is related to the tuition and education expenses, but I don't know if that will work. What's your opinion about that?
My opinion is that it's a very good question, but the problem is that you cannot take qualified tax-free distributions from a 529 plan to pay off of a student loan. Now, is this 529 plan, Beatrice, does it have a lot of accumulated gains in it, meaning have you made a lot of money on it?
You know, I don't even really know about it. My husband started that account, and he passed away 7 years ago. I have not contributed any more money since. And in 2008, the account went really down, you know, for the market, and since has recuperated very well. So I do not know how really even to consider if that money earned after the market fall down. Would that be gains, or I don't know?
There are a couple things you can do. First, I would check with the provider, whoever is sending you the statements on the 529 account. They should have all the deposits on record, and they can tell you if the deposits exceed the value or are less than the value, and therefore how much gain or loss you might have. And then you can always pull that out. And whenever you want, the only time you'll pay a penalty is if you don't use the money for qualified expenses, and then you'll pay taxes and penalties on the earnings. You can also gift it to the kids in question, and then they'll probably be in a very low tax bracket when they're done with school, and then they can pull it out, and they can use it, and then their taxes will be relatively relatively low because they're in a low bracket. That could minimize the penalty as well. You could also look at saving the 529 to the final year of the kids are in school and have them not get a loan and just cash it out, pay for qualified expenses at that time, and then it will, any gains, of course, will be tax-free. But finally, I would caution you, Beatrice, if you were waiting, if you've had kind of a roller coaster ride on this account over the last 5 years or so, it's been good for the last 5 years, but it sounds like it was bad in 2008, 2009. If it's still invested the same way, I would caution you against hanging on to the account just because you think you're going to get more interest on it, meaning that if it went down a lot in 2008, 2009, and it's still invested the same way, it's just as possible or as likely to go down in the next year or two or three or 4 years. So be very careful about hanging on to it just for that reason. Unless it's in a fixed account that pays a guaranteed rate of interest, it's unlikely that you can guarantee that you'll just keep clipping along over the next 3 to 5 years like you have in the last 3 to 5 years.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean. And then there is not in a fixed rate account. It has been a variable. I know that you can suggest how to move or to set up the money or the what shares to buy, but I'm not knowledgeable enough, so I just have to let it alone. And yeah, that was my idea, to just wait and let it keep growing so it had more money to help them pay her.
Sure, and it may, and I hope it does for your sake and a lot of other people, but that alone is probably not the best reason to hang on to the account and take out more loans, because you could find a situation where you're paying interest on the loans and the value of the 529 has gone down again, especially if you're going to use it in the next few years. 529s can be invested fairly aggressively as long as you've got a long time frame, meaning you may have 10 to 20 years until you're going to use the money. But as the kids get older and it becomes more likely that they're going to actually spend it on qualified education expenses, that's when you usually want to become more conservative with it.
Thank you, Beatrice, for the call. Doreen in Madison is with us now. Hi, Doreen.
Hi. My question is about how do I find out the most accurate options for how to take Social Security for our particular situation? There's a lot of conflicting advice, and even people say they call Social Security a couple of different times and get different agents and get different answers.
Yeah, what's the deal with that, Kevin?
Well, that's actually, that's true. The Social Security Administration people I've dealt with have generally been extremely helpful, and they're knowledgeable enough about the situation where they don't go as far as providing specific advice, but they do point out different strategies people can use to maybe collect more money over their lifetime or different timings, things that they can use. But in terms of getting the actual distribution amount, it can be confusing, especially, are you married, Doreen?
Yes, and my spouse has been getting Social Security disability. We're now, starting our 60s, and I've read a lot of conflicting things online. Some of them's kind of scary, so I don't know where to go.
Okay, I would still go back. The good people with the Social Security Administration are still the final decision makers on what you have available to you. And so I would actually, have you made an appointment to sit down and talk with them yet?
No, huh?
Okay, I would do that. I'd call them up, explain the situation, bring in your questions to them, and then say, what are our different options for it? And they'll actually give you a printout and say, okay, if you take your money now, this is how much you'll get. If you wait, this is what the check is likely to be based on waiting. Here are your spousal Social Security options, which can be tricky. And usually, you know, for most people, it's a good idea to wait from a financial standpoint. But most people do not wait. The majority of them take it before reaching 63 or 64 years old. And there are a lot of good reasons to do that, especially if you need the money. It's better to have it, the bird in the hand, versus waiting for two in the proverbial bush. So I would call your local Social Security Administration office and set up an appointment, and you'll be one of hundreds of people who will probably call today and make the same request, and that's what they get paid to do.
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you, Doreen. Thanks very much for calling. We'll move now to Brad in Whiting. Hello, Brad. What's your question?
Hi there. I need help shopping for Medicare supplement insurance plan. And I know the state of Wisconsin gives generic advice about what a Medicare supplement is, but they don't help with shopping, you know, comparing one company to another company. All the supplements are the same plan. It's just I want to know, when you're comparing companies, what to look for, like their history of premium increases and things like that, and their reputation and their rating. And I need to find someone in this state that can give me unbiased insurance advice. And because I'm not an expert in this, and I'm lost, and I need help, and I don't know where to go.
Okay. Yeah, this is going to be a sad refrain in the future, Brad, for your situation, because even when people would qualify for Medicare, and find a program that you like if you're purchasing supplemental insurance, what's going to happen is every single year, either the programs are going to change, or the laws are going to change, or your situation's going to change. And therefore, every October, you're going to have to go back in and shop for it. There's a company out of Illinois called AllSup. It's allsup.com. And they will provide an analysis of your situation and suggest different providers or different plans based on where you're at. And we'll put a link up to the website at onyourmoney.com. Otherwise, you can try to find, you know, an independent insurance agent or whatever, but even then you've got to find someone who has, you know, the background in it. And the policies change so much from one company to the next. They're standard in terms of the supplemental care, but they can change from one year to the other. And of course, our health situations change as well. So I tried that website for it and see what they can offer you. Again, it's probably going to cost you a few hundred dollars to do it, but for something this urgent, if you can get a satisfactory result from it, I think it's worth it.
Good luck to you, Brad. Thanks for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It is time now for Smart Assets, and today's Smart Asset discussion is actually about a liability. What liability, Kevin?
Yeah, smart liabilities just didn't have quite the ring to it. So it's called a HELOC, and it stands for a Home Equity Line of Credit. And it's been in the news recently because BMO Harris, a bank which has a significant presence in the state of Wisconsin, called several people, contacted them who had HELOCs through BMO Harris and said, you know what, we need to start thinking about repaying this loan, and hopefully you can refinance it, but if not, technically we have the right to demand repayment of the money you have borrowed through this HELOC.
Yikes. So give us some background. What exactly is a HELOC?
It's a line of credit. It's not a loan, but once you've established it, it allows you to borrow against the established equity in your home, usually up to 80% of the value, and especially once you combine it with your mortgage. So let's say you have a house that's worth $200,000, and you have a mortgage that has a balance of about $100,000. You, in theory, could get a HELOC worth about $60,000 that would allow you to tap up to 80% of the total loan to value ratio of your house once you add the mortgage in.
Why would a homeowner want a HELOC?
Well, you generally want to have one so that you can tap it if you need it, when you want it, rather than having to apply for it as well. If you want to shop for one, you can start by going one to back to the original lender, but you can shop around. You can get HELOCs from all different kinds of lending institutions. The application and the fees to get a HELOC are much smaller usually than what you would pay if you were getting a traditional mortgage. And you absolutely can find places that do it for virtually nothing. They just do it as a sale that they're having on it. If you haven't had an appraisal for your house in a while, you may have to pay for one of those. That can be several hundred dollars. But once you're approved, then you get the home equity line of credit to use it however you want.
All right. So how do you use it?
You tap it when you want. And once you're approved, you only pay interest on what you borrow. The rate is traditionally very low, especially right now. You're looking at maybe 4 to 6% interest on it. But that rate can be adjustable. And there are parameters set up in advance that tell you how much the rate can go up in a given year and maybe even what the cap is over the lifetime of the loan. Because you're borrowing against the home equity, the interest can be tax deductible. And again, eventually you do have to pay the loan off, or what more people do, if they can't do it at a specific time, they convert it to a fixed rate home loan. And next week, we are going to be offering a very special pledge premium for people who call in during On Your Money. We are going to be offering the On Your Money Mini Money Booklet, Making the Most of Your Mortgage, that will give you lots of information, not only on home equity lines of credit, but also mortgages, why you would want one, why you should pay it off early, why you might want to get a new one, reverse mortgages for people who are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, all kinds of things with that. But again, that's only to people who pledge during next week's edition of On Your Money.
Did you say we have a pledge drive next week, Kevin?
I think so. I'm going to swing by for that. I just put it in myself.
Yeah. Well, no, we do. And that sounds like a wonderful thank you gift, making the most of your mortgage. So what would you say to those HELOC owners who are worried that their bank may demand repayment?
Well, it's unfortunate for the individuals who are getting contacted. And the bank isn't any happier about this. But this is actually a good thing for the banking system in general, because what people are concerned about, of course, is what we alluded to earlier, that people have borrowed money that they may not be able to repay very quickly, and the value of their home may be lower than what was when they were originally given the HELOC, and therefore the bank could be upside down on the loan along with the lender for it. And if the lender can't repay the home equity line of credit, it means that the bank could get in trouble if the lender has to be foreclosed upon or the borrower. So it's a good thing that to say that, hey, they're tightening the strings and trying to make things a little bit more conservative, but it does put the borrower in an unfortunate situation. They should contact the lender, have a discussion with it, see what options are out there. You might be able to refinance it into a new fixed rate 30-year mortgage, which may keep your payments low but allow you to mitigate the home equity line of credit payment. Or you might be able to convert it to a fixed rate home equity loan as well, which might have a little higher interest rate but a shorter payment period. You may have to tap other assets to pay it off. When it comes to this, it's a tough decision, but tapping retirement accounts or other savings accounts, it's if it's possible to do that, this may be the best option, because after that, if you can't repay it off and the bank says we still need you to do so, you may have to sell your home.
Well, okie doke. Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. here with information and advice on your money. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I take that back. Send that email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Hillary in Chilton. Hello, Hillary.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead. What's your question?
I've heard about having your Social Security number frozen for children, and I was wondering what Kevin thought about that. I don't know if that really goes with the theme or if that's necessarily money, but we have a 3-month-old daughter, and I was wondering if freezing her Social Security number would be a good idea to prevent any identity theft for her.
No, I think it can be a great idea. And basically what you're talking about when freezing a Social Security number, you're really are putting a freeze on her credit report, meaning that the credit bureaus cannot access the report if you have not already had a relationship with them or you are not unfrozen your credit report to give them access to it so that they can open up a credit card. But it's a less common but still valid concern about people using not only the Social Security numbers of children or senior citizens, but also people who've passed away and opening up credit cards or other kinds of loans in that person's name and Social Security number, getting as much money out of it as they can, and then skating before they get a chance to pay it off. And so, and I think it's a very good idea to do that. If you go to, tinyurl.com/cfreeze, tinyurl.com/cfreeze, there's a website there that tells residents of every state in the country what their particular state's process is for freezing a credit report. It does cost you about $10 to freeze it with each bureau, and if you need to thaw it or unfreeze it for future use, it's cost $10 to thaw it and then $10 to freeze it again, but it's a relatively inexpensive way to help prevent against identity theft, not only for yourself, but your daughter as well.
All right, Hillary. Well, thanks very much for the call.
She you just know, took off.
Yeah,
and
she did.
She's on a mission.
She's right? Freezing that Social Security number for her child. You know, when I saw Hillary in Chilton, when I looked over at the computer, I thought, Hillary Clinton's calling.
Wouldn't surprise me. She's actually getting to be a little pest. We blocked her number. I mean, I like her, but I just we can't take her calls every
She's
single week.
She's always calling, yeah. Betsy in McFarland is with us. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, I was listening to the previous caller who had questions about Medicare supplement policies and the companies that offer them, and I would like to suggest that he take a look at the website and contact the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance. That website is oci.wi.gov. They have a lot of information about Medicare supplement policies, the different kinds of policies, and as well in their financial section, they can give you the ratings of the companies and the histories of premium increases and complaints about the company. They have a lot of information there.
Do you want to debate her, Kevin?
No, it's nice to finally get some helpful advice on this show after 10 years of doing it. So thank you, Betsy. Yes, I think in the brief information that Brad provided, I think he had actually seen that, but the problem is of course, that takes a lot of work to go through all that. And even then, you don't know what your future experience is going to be like with the company based on their passport. But Betsy's right. The Office of Commissioner Insurance actually has a really great website with lots of information that's very helpful, not just about Medicare supplement insurance, but long-term care insurance. If you have a homeowner's insurance problem, a car insurance problem, and you're a resident of the state of Wisconsin, it's a great place to turn for unbiased advice.
Thank you, Betsy, for that information. More information and advice on your money with Kevin McKinley, financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
My mama told me you better shop around.
Millions of PC users may be dismayed to find out that their particular operating system is no longer being supported by the manufacturer. What's going on, Kevin?
It's those with running Windows XP. It's a program that's actually about 13 years old. About 30% of PC users still have it and are still using it. That's about 400 million laptops and PCs are estimated to have this on worldwide. But as of April 8th, Microsoft announced that they are no longer supporting Windows XP.
Well, what does that mean to the users of Windows XP?
Your computer will blow up, actually.
Oh, no.
If it hasn't already. No, it will still operate, but Microsoft is not going to be providing any security protection updates or fixes for any bugs that are noticed. And it's fairly common. It's just that that we don't hear about it quite as often for it. And you'll still be able to get those security updates and find fixes for bugs, but there'll be third-party providers, and so it'll be harder to find, and they'll be less reliable. And in the future, if you are going to try to run Windows XP because you like to be a vintage computer user or whatever, you're going to find it much harder to find compatible hardware and software programs as well.
You know, I'm such a vintage computer user that I don't even know if I have Windows XP. So what options do Windows XP users have?
Well, you can do nothing. You can still use it, but it will be a less secure and less supported, obviously, program. But you might want to upgrade to a newer version of Windows. The cost is usually going to be around $100, whether you choose Windows 7, 8, or 8.1. But there have been some problems with that. 7 is getting harder to find, and Windows 8 has had some issues with it, especially because Microsoft is trying to turn themselves into a tablet software provider, so they wanted to go with a touchscreen, and people have had complaints about that, like they always do with any new version of software. And then you can go to 8.1, which there have been issues with that because it's a relatively new program. You could try to download some kind of Linux program as well, but if you haven't done that already, you probably shouldn't start because it can be a little complicated. But even if you do go ahead and try to download those new updates to Windows, your PC might not be big enough to handle it. And even if it is, you have to do a clean install, meaning you have to wipe out everything on your current PC, the entire operating system, back the whole thing up, wipe it out, and then install the new operating system as well.
Oh, okay, then what?
Well, if that creates a problem for you, it might just be cheaper and easier to break down and finally get a new PC. You're going to look at a laptop, spending probably $300 to $3,000. Similar price range for a PC. An Apple's going to probably start you at $800 to $900 at least for a laptop. Might look at a tablet or a Chromebook. But when I look at this, I get as bummed out about this as anybody. But I look at how much I use the computer versus the cost of a new one, and hopefully one that will work even better, be faster, safer, with security updates. And the average, cost per hour of use, if you will, is very small for most people. But in the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about which new PC, tablet, laptop, Chromebook solution is right for you.
Sounds good. Looking forward to that. And now I know when you said it that I have Windows 7. So I'm okay for a little while, Kevin?
You're cool.
Okay, good. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And we have Ron in Eau Claire with us next. Hello, Ron.
Hello, and thank you very much for taking my call. My question is, Kevin, at what age do you recommend starting to be more careful with the money you have invested? I've got about 30% in a fix, and the rest is, well, as everybody else, you hope to make the most biggest gains and the highest risk. But I'll be 58 shortly, and I'd like to work until, 65, 67 if I could, but I'm just debating whether some of it should be put more into a fix just to kind of protect the money instead of, depending on this long run we've had now of good luck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't go by a specific age. I would rather have you look at two different things. First of all, do you need growth at all? If someone gave you $10 million, you'd probably say, hey, I could bury that in the hole in the ground, and that will provide more money than I could ever possibly spend. Therefore, you don't need growth, and you don't have to take risk. And the second thing is where are you at in your life? Some people retire at 58. Other people work for 10 or 15 years longer than that. If that's the case, I think you can afford a little more risk because you're going to be hopefully adding to that, and you don't need the money today because you're going to be spending your own income rather than tapping the assets. What I would like you to do, regardless of the age, Ron, if you are concerned about a portion of the portfolio dropping, which should be, all assets, especially ones that provide greater return, have greater risk and have a greater chance of dropping than something that provides very little return and therefore very little risk. What I'd look at doing is maybe rebalancing. Let's say you had half of your money in bonds and half of it in stocks. And because the stock market has done very well in the last few years, now you have 60% of your money in stocks and 40% in bonds. You might want to rebalance and move it back so it's 50-50. That doesn't guarantee that you're not going to lose money, but it means that you are selling a portion of the portfolio that has risen and you're reducing the amount of risk that you have for the portfolio as well. But again, I'd be cautious about being too aggressive, especially at this point, and especially on the cusp of retirement. You know, people in their late 50s and early 60s sometimes say, you know what, I'm fine working. I don't care about the stock market because I'm not going to need this money for a long time. And then for whatever reason, whether they have health issues or their employer says, you know, you'd love to stay here, but we can't pay you anymore. Mm-hmm. They have to leave. And then all of a sudden, they're a lot more concerned about where their money is invested.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron. Good luck to you. Clifford in Green Bay is with us now. Hello, Clifford.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is about the term land contract that was used for real estate transactions some time ago, but I never hear of it anymore. Is that vehicle still used? Is it legal?
Yeah, sure. It's legal, and it's actually used quite often by people who are willing to finance a sale to a person of a particular piece of real estate property, and they have a contract for sale. And basically how it works is, let's say someone wants to buy your house for $200,000. You might say, well, give me 20. They can't get a loan at the bank or whatever. You might say, well, give me 20% of the money up front, and then the remaining amount we'll pay interest on for 5 years on a land contract. And if for whatever reason you either can't make the payments or you violate the terms of the contract, the original seller gets the land or the property back, and the buyer has really no recourse generally over it. And it's basically a term for self-financing, for being the bank of a particular property that you're looking to sell. And it can work out very nicely as long as you're comfortable basically being the bank for a particular piece of property.
Thank you, Clifford. Jim in Milwaukee is with us now. Hello, Jim.
Yes, good morning. I have a question. I'm due to start getting my pension from a previous employer, and I can take the full amount or I can take a reduced amount and get a survivor's benefit. It'd be reduced by about 14%. One other option I was thinking of is take the full amount and use some of that additional money to buy a life insurance policy to protect my life if I die first. I'm wondering if you had a thought on which way might be better. The pension that she would get if I die first would be half what I would currently get.
Okay. It's a great subject to bring up, because a lot of times when people are looking at pensions, they say, well, I won't be around, so what difference does it make if we don't if we have a smaller check or there's no check for it? And what a lot of married couples don't take into consideration is that if they're also relying on Social Security in retirement, that when the first member of the couple dies, the smaller Social Security check disappears, meaning that whoever's a survivor generally gets the higher of the two checks, but that can also mean a bigger deal. So I would encourage you to maximize the amount of pension that you can receive regardless if either of you pass away. So I prefer you go with a larger survivor benefit, take a smaller check now. And then the notion of buying life insurance with the difference, usually purchasing life insurance in a later stage in life can be so expensive and get eaten up so much by just the general fees and commissions of the policy, especially in the early years of it, that I don't recommend you use the extra money to do that. Usually won't work out very well whether you live a long time or a short time.
Thanks very much, Jim, for the call. Let's see, we have Dave in Waukesha with us now. Hi, Dave. What's your question?
Hello. Getting to the point that Kevin mentioned about 529s versus so-called retirement loans, I was wondering why one couldn't consider these HELOCs and reverse mortgages basically as retirement loans.
You mean like saying you can't get a loan to retire, but you can get a loan for college?
Right.
Yeah, I think it's you actually bring up a really good point, and I think that people who are retiring should have a home equity line of credit. In some cases, maybe even should get a new mortgage. And it sounds crazy. They say, well, this is a time I want low expenses. I don't want any debt. I don't want any mortgage payments. But having no money and no mortgage is riskier than having the money and the mortgage payment, because in theory, you can always slide the money over at any given time. But no, I definitely recommend it. But it's just, it's harder now to get a loan as a retiree for a mortgage or for a home equity line of credit than it was, say, 5 or 10 years ago. But no, I definitely think they just won't let you call it a loan to retire. It can work out that way. But if you walk into a bank and say, I would like a retirement loan, I'm pretty sure that you will be escorted out.
Well, it seems like just a matter of labels.
Yes, sir, you're correct.
That's right. Thank you, Dave. All right, Sue emails, I love your show and listen to it religiously. Now that I got that false praise in there, very smart listeners, my daughter is taking out loans to pay for medical school. This summer, she will earn some money doing research. It will be her last chance to make money before she graduates in 3 years. Should she make a contribution to her Roth IRA, pay off the accrued loan interest, or pay for school rather than take a larger loan?
The safest choice is the one that seems to be the least obvious, and that is just to put the money in a checking account, because she can do all of those things with the money at some point. She may want to put it in as a Roth IRA, meaning use like a very safe investment as a Roth IRA, because she can pull those contributions back out from the Roth IRA whenever she wants with no taxes or penalties. But saving for retirement right now is not her biggest issue. It's going to be making payments on all of these different loans. And I would rather have her actually take the loan out for school and keep the savings intact, because then she can make the minimum payments required on the loan and stay current on it and scramble around every 30 days trying to figure out where the next payment money is going to come from, rather than saying, oh, well, gee, I graduated from school and I have a little less debt out, but I don't have any cash to live off of. Can I go back to the school and say, hey, can I retroactively borrow some student loan money for living expenses now? They won't let her do that, of course. So I'd rather have her pay a little interest on the loan and keep her savings intact.
All right. Thanks, Sue. Good luck to you and your daughter. So, Kevin, what's the website of the week?
The website of the week is one of our favorite ones, whether you are thinking about getting a credit card, looking to transfer a balance, or you're having problems paying your credit cards off. It's naturallycreditcards.com. Lots of good search tools on there, lots of good articles about what to do if you're in any of these situations. Creditcards.com, and that will be up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And next week, Pledge Drive and Making the Most of Your Mortgage?
Yes, we have not offered this On Your Money Mini Money booklet for about almost 4 years, and it was very popular the last time we had it, and it will be even more popular now, I predict, because a lot of people are wondering what to do with their mortgage. Should they pay it off? Should they take out a new one? Should they slow it down? What should they do with the money if they do get a new one? What to do with home equity lines of credit? How should we handle reverse mortgages if we or our parents are thinking about getting one? Everything, answers to all those questions will be contained in the On Your Money Mini Money booklet, Making the Most of Your Mortgage. And like almost all of the premium we have at On Your Money, it is available to people who pledge at any dollar amount whatsoever.
And that will be a show to look forward to. That's next week on Your Money. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He is with us every Tuesday at this time with information and advice on your money. On Your Money airs live Tuesday mornings from 8 until 9. It is repeated. It is rebroadcast Tuesday evenings from 9 until 10. And then we have a rebroadcast as well on Sundays from 7 until 8 a.m. Thanks very much to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.